And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Is it just me? I can't remember a time when 2 weeks before Christmas, stories about the environment were making big news. It's been a big week on the environmental front as the U.S. Senate drops the energy bill, while Al Gore finally wins the big one, the Nobel Peace Prize, that is. And in Bali, the battle over global warming is heating up. And we visit a university campus to see what's on students' minds besides finals. That's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
You know what they always say? You win a few, you lose a few. Losers? In the battle between the oil industries and the American people, the people got knocked out in the ninth round. We'll be talking about the Senate's cave-in on the energy bill during the Nature News in Segment 2. Still battling, the 190 nations meeting in the historic UN Conference on Global Warming, which is in its second week in Bali. There's a real battle royale emerging between the haves and the developing haves as the U.S. representatives reflect the administration's legacy of going it alone against the rest of the world, and in so doing, appears to be generally weakening the potential significance of the conference. We'll bring you a brief summary during the Nature News beginning in Segment 2. Winners? Al Gore. He received his medal for the Nobel Peace Prize as the man who has united the world in the effort to combat global warming. We'll be featuring his acceptance speech during the weekly Earth Summit, which is about to convene in just a moment. And in Segment 2, following the news, we'll be talking with university students to see what the generation most directly affected by global warming is thinking about. Do they care? Are they thinking? You'll find out in Segment 2, as we talk with Catherine, Eric, Jean, Caleb, Lynn, and Maximilian. But now, it's time for the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith, and I'm thrilled to be able to bring you Al Gore's Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech, which he delivered to a prestigious crowd of dignitaries in Norway. There is much to be learned as Al Gore receives worldwide recognition for his carbide-tipped tongue that would not stop spinning out the message of the dangers to the Earth from global warming. He serves as an inspiration to the rest of us who speak the truth, as we all must do, now and for a very long time into the future. I am proud to introduce to you Al Gore, Nobel Peace Prize recipient 2007.
Your Majesties, Your Royal Highnesses, Honorable Members of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, I have a purpose here today. It is a purpose I have tried to serve for many years. I have prayed that God would show me a way to accomplish it. Sometimes, without warning, the future knocks on our door with a precious and painful vision of what might be. 119 years ago, a wealthy inventor read his own obituary, mistakenly published years before his death. Wrongly believing the inventor had just died, a newspaper printed a harsh judgment of his life's work, unfairly labeling him the merchant of death because of his invention, dynamite. Shaken by this condemnation, the inventor made a faithful choice to serve the cause of peace. 7 years later, Alfred Nobel created this prize and the others that bear his name. 7 years ago tomorrow, I read my own political obituary in a judgment that seemed to me harsh and mistaken, if not premature. But that unwelcome verdict also brought a precious, if painful, gift, an opportunity to search for fresh new ways to serve my purpose. Unexpectedly, that quest has brought me here. Even though I fear my words cannot match this moment, I pray that what I'm feeling in my heart will be communicated clearly enough that those who hear me will say, we must act. The distinguished scientists with whom it is the greatest honor of my life to share this award have laid before us a choice between two different futures, a choice that to my ears echoes the words of an ancient prophet, life or death, blessings or curses, therefore choose life, that both thou and thy seed may live. We, the human species, are confronting a planetary emergency, a threat to the survival of our civilization that is gathering ominous and destructive potential even as we gather here. But there is hopeful news as well. We have the ability to solve this crisis and avoid the worst, though not all, of its consequences if we act boldly, decisively, and quickly. However, despite a growing number of honorable exceptions, too many of the world's leaders are still best described in the words Winston Churchill applied to those who ignored Adolf Hitler's threat. And I quote, "They go on in strange paradox, decided only to be undecided, resolved to be irresolute, adamant for drift, solid for fluidity, all powerful to be impotent." So today, we dumped another 70 million tons of global warming pollution into the thin shell of atmosphere surrounding our planet as if it were an open sewer. And tomorrow we will dump a slightly larger amount, with the cumulative concentrations now trapping more and more heat from the sun. As a result, the Earth has a fever, and the fever is rising. The experts have told us it is not a passing affliction that will heal by itself. We ask for a second opinion, and a third, and a fourth. And the consistent conclusion, restated with increasing distress, is that something basic is wrong. We are what is wrong, and we must make it right. Last September 21st, as the northern hemisphere tilted away from the sun, scientists reported with unprecedented alarm that the North Polar ice cap is, in their words, falling off a cliff. One study estimated that it could be completely gone during summer in less than 22 years. Another new study to be presented by U.S. Navy researchers later this week warns it could happen in as little as 7 years. 7 years from now. In the last few months, it has been harder and harder to misinterpret the signs that our world is spinning out of kilter. Major cities in North and South America, Asia, and Australia are nearly out of water due to massive droughts and melting glaciers. Desperate farmers are losing their livelihoods. Peoples in the frozen Arctic and on low-lying Pacific islands are planning evacuations of places they have long called home. Unprecedented wildfires have forced a half a million people from their homes in one country and caused a national emergency that almost brought down the government in another. Climate refugees have migrated into areas already inhabited by people with different cultures, religions, and traditions, increasing the potential for conflict. Stronger storms in the Atlantic and the Pacific have threatened whole cities. Millions have been displaced by massive flooding in South Asia, Mexico, and 18 countries in Africa. As temperature extremes have increased, tens of thousands have lost their lives. We are recklessly burning and clearing our forests and driving more and more species into extinction. The very web of life on which we depend is being ripped and frayed. We never intended to cause all this destruction, just as Alfred Nobel never intended that dynamite be used for waging war. He had hoped his invention would promote human progress. We shared that same worthy goal when we began burning massive quantities of coal, then oil, and natural gas. Even in Nobel's time, there were a few warnings of the likely consequences. One of the very first winners of the prize in chemistry worried that, in his words, we are evaporating our coal mines into the air. After performing 10,000 equations by hand, Svante Arrhenius calculated that the Earth's average temperature would increase by many degrees if we doubled the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. 70 years later, my teacher Roger Revelle and his colleague Dave Keeling began to precisely document the increasing CO2 levels day by day. But unlike most other forms of pollution, CO2 is invisible, tasteless, and odorless, which has helped keep the truth about what it is doing to our climate out of sight and out of mind. Moreover, the catastrophe now threatening us is unprecedented, and we often confuse the unprecedented with the improbable. We also find it hard to imagine making the massive changes that are now necessary to solve the crisis. And when large truths are genuinely inconvenient, whole societies can, at least for a time, ignore them. Yet, as George Orwell reminds us, sooner or later, a false belief bumps up against a solid reality, usually on a battlefield. In the years since this prize was first awarded, the entire relationship between humankind and the Earth has been radically transformed. And still, we have remained largely oblivious to the impact of our cumulative actions. Indeed, without realizing it, we have begun to wage war on the Earth itself. Now we and the Earth's climate are locked in a relationship familiar to war planners, mutually assured destruction. More than two decades ago, scientists calculated that nuclear war could throw so much debris and smoke into the air it would block life-giving sunlight from our atmosphere, causing a nuclear winter. Their eloquent warnings here in Oslo helped galvanize the world's resolve to halt the nuclear arms race. Now science is warning us that if we do not quickly reduce the global warming pollution that is trapping so much of the heat our planet normally radiates back out of the atmosphere, we are in danger of creating a permanent carbon summer. As the American poet Robert Frost wrote, "Some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. Either," he notes, "would suffice. But neither need be our fate. It is time to make peace with the planet. We must quickly mobilize our civilization with the urgency and resolve that has previously been seen only when nations mobilized for war. These prior struggles for survival were won when leaders found words at the 11th hour that released a mighty surge of courage, hope, and readiness to sacrifice for a protracted and mortal struggle. These were not comforting and misleading assurances that the threat was not real, not imminent, that it would afflict others but not ourselves, that ordinary life might be lived even in the presence of extraordinary threat, that providence could be trusted to do for us what we would not do for ourselves. No, these were calls to come to the defense of the common future. They were calls upon the courage, generosity, and strength of entire peoples, citizens of every class and condition who were ready to stand against the threat once asked to do so. Our enemies in those times calculated that free people would not rise to the challenge. They were, of course, catastrophically wrong. Now comes the threat of climate crisis, a threat that is real, rising, imminent, and universal. Once again, it is the 11th hour. The penalties for ignoring this challenge are immense and growing, and at some near point would be unsustainable and unrecoverable. For now, we still have the power to choose our fate. And the remaining question is only this: have we the will to act vigorously and in time, or will we remain imprisoned by a dangerous illusion? Mahatma Gandhi awakened the largest democracy on earth and forged a shared resolve with what he called Satyagraha, or truth force. In every land, the truth, once known, has the power to set us free. Truth also has the power to unite us and bridge the distance between me and we, creating the basis for common effort and shared responsibility. There is an African proverb that says, if you want to go quickly, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. We need to go far, quickly. We must abandon the conceit that individual, isolated, private actions are the answer. They can and do help, but they will not take us far enough without collective action. At the same time, we must ensure that in mobilizing globally, we do not invite the establishment of ideological conformity and a new lockstep-ism. That means adopting principles, values, laws, and treaties that release creativity and initiative at every level of society in multifold responses originating concurrently and spontaneously. This new consciousness requires expanding the possibilities inherent in all humanity. The innovators who will devise a new way to harness the sun's energy for pennies or invent an engine that's carbon negative may live in Lagos or Mumbai or Montevideo. We must ensure that entrepreneurs and inventors everywhere on the globe have the chance to change the world. When we unite for a moral purpose that is manifestly good and true, the spiritual energy unleashed can transform us. The generation that defeated fascism throughout the world in the 1940s found in rising to meet their awesome challenge that they had gained the moral authority and long-term vision to launch the Marshall Plan, the United Nations, and a new level of global cooperation and foresight that unified Europe and facilitated the emergence of democracy in Japan, Germany, Italy, and much of the world. One of their visionary leaders said, "It is time we steered by the stars and not by the lights of every passing ship." In the last year of that war, you gave the Peace Prize to a man from my hometown of 2,000 people, Carthage, Tennessee, in the USA. Cordell Hull was described by Franklin Roosevelt as the father of the United Nations. He was an inspiration and hero to my own father, who followed Hull in the Congress and the U.S. Senate, and in his commitment to world peace and global cooperation. My parents spoke often of Hull, always in tones of reverence and admiration. 8 weeks ago, when you announced this prize, the deepest emotion I felt was when I saw the headline in my hometown paper that simply noted I had won the same prize that Cordell Hull had won. In that moment, I knew what my father and mother would have felt were they alive. Just as Hull's generation found moral authority in rising to solve the world crisis caused by fascism, so can we find our greatest opportunity in rising to solve the climate crisis. In the kanji characters used in both Chinese and Japanese, crisis is written with two symbols, the first meaning danger, the second opportunity. By facing and removing the danger of the climate crisis, we have the opportunity to gain the moral authority and vision to vastly increase our own capacity to solve other crises that have been too long ignored. We must understand the connections between the climate crisis and the afflictions of poverty, hunger, HIV, AIDS, and other pandemics. As these problems are linked, so too must be their solutions. We must begin by making the common rescue of the global environment the central organizing principle of the world community. 15 years ago, I made that case at the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro. 10 years ago, I presented it in Kyoto. This week, I will urge the delegates in Bali to adopt a bold mandate for a treaty that establishes a universal global cap on emissions and uses the market in emissions trading to efficiently allocate resources to the most effective opportunities for speedy reductions. This treaty should be ratified and brought into effect everywhere in the world by the beginning of 2010, 2 years sooner than presently contemplated. The pace of our response must be accelerated to match the accelerating pace of the crisis itself. Heads of state should meet early next year to review what was accomplished in Bali and take personal responsibility for addressing this crisis. It is not unreasonable to ask, given the gravity of our circumstances, that these heads of state meet every 3 months until this treaty is completed. We also need a moratorium on the construction of any new generating facility that burns coal without the capacity to safely trap and store carbon dioxide. And most important of all, we need to put a price on carbon with a CO2 tax that is then rebated back to the people progressively according to the laws of each nation in ways that shift the burden of taxation from employment to pollution. This is by far the most effective and simplest way to accelerate solutions to this crisis. The world now needs an alliance, especially of those nations that weigh heaviest in the scales where Earth is in the balance. I salute Europe and Japan for the steps they've taken in recent years to meet the challenge, and the new government in Australia, which has made solving the climate crisis its first priority. But the outcome will be decisively influenced by two nations that are now failing to do enough, the United States and China. While India is also growing fast in importance, it should be absolutely clear that it is the two largest CO2 emitters, and most of all my own country, that will need to make the boldest moves or stand accountable before history for their failure to act. Both countries should stop using the other's behavior as an excuse for stalemate and instead develop an agenda for mutual survival in a shared global environment. These are the last few years of decision, but they can be the first years of a bright and hopeful future if we do what we must. No one should believe a solution will be found without effort, without cost, without change. Let us acknowledge that if we wish to redeem squandered time and speak again with moral authority, then these are the hard truths. The way ahead is difficult. The outer boundary of what we currently believe to be feasible is still far short of what we actually must do. Moreover, between here and there, across the unknown, falls the shadow. That is just another way of saying that we have to expand the boundaries of what is possible. In the words of the Spanish poet Antonio Machado, "Pathwalker, there is no path. You must make the path as you walk." We are standing at the most fateful fork in that path. So I want to end as I began, with a vision of two futures, each a palpable possibility, and with a prayer that we will see with vivid clarity the necessity of choosing between those two futures and the urgency of making the right choice now. The great Norwegian playwright Henrik Ibsen wrote, "One of these days, the younger generation will come knocking at my door." The future is knocking at our door right now. Make no mistake, the next generation will ask us one of two questions. Either they will ask, "What were you thinking? Why didn't you act?" Or they will ask instead, "How did you find the moral courage to rise and successfully resolve a crisis that so many said was impossible to solve?" We have everything we need to get started, save perhaps political will. But political will is a renewable resource. So let us renew it, and let us say together, we have a purpose. We are many. For this purpose, we will rise and we will act.
Thank you, Mr. Gore. And safe journey now on to Bali to address the UN Climate Change Conference. We'll be covering your address there next week when we bring you the most important 15 minutes on Earth, the weekly Earth Summit. Lest anyone doubt the emergence of globalization, this week's environmental news is filled with places like Bali, Kyoto, and Oslo, which bears a strange resemblance to an historic interpretation of a bad storm, or tornado actually, when Dorothy says to Toto, "We're not in Kansas anymore." We're heading off to Bali to bring you an update, and then we hear what university students are thinking about the future of their Earth when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
As delegates from around the world meet in Bali to plan for the possible healing of the planet, there's a generation of students who will feel the pain if the right prescription is not written soon. Do they know what's going on? We take a sampling of what college kids are thinking and an update from the Bali Conference and more when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. You know, we're focusing on the Bali Conference, which we'll provide a summary of in just a moment, as well as what's happened to the energy bill that passed the House during this week's Nature News. But here's my bottom line on the battle in Bali that's in Round 7 as we speak. In the years ahead, the Bali roadmap will be drawn up as a result of the conference. And it's obvious that the U.S., Canada, Japan, and China, and other industrialized nations are kicking out the teeth in the agreement. But I've been watching this world for a few years now, and I think this is on the mark. We won't get the perfect agreement at this conference, but here's the great news, and the operative thought to take home with you. The whole world is talking. And that, my friends, is the best news we've had in quite a while. Talking is the magic elixir of change. It has the amazing ability to penetrate through even the thickest skull with time. That's the way it always works, whether it be between two people or two opposing worlds. No one likes to admit they're wrong, but through time everyone has the right to claim that they've changed their view. And despite some of the less than stellar reports on the Bali Conference, just wait and see where we all are 10 years from now. I'm guessing we will be living in an advancing clean tech world with new and inventive solutions to many of our problems. That's my prediction. And I'm willing to bet a dollar I'm right. Any takers? Following this week's Nature News, we're heading to UCSD, the University of California, San Diego, to hear what students are thinking about nature and the environment. That's coming up. But first, the news. The House passed the new energy bill, 235 to 181, in what Democrats characterized as a new direction. the bill rolled back $13.5 billion in tax benefits to oil companies and transferred them to companies involved in developing new energy sources. The bill also set a requirement for auto companies to boost fuel economy by 40% by 2020, the first such increase since 1975. And it required utilities to generate a large chunk of electricity from sources such as solar and wind energy. The White House warned that if Congress passed the bill, President Bush would veto it. The U.S. Senate then picked up the bill the next day and voted 53-42, short of the 60 votes needed, to move it to a final vote, influenced largely by oil and energy interests who disliked the tax shift and the clean tech provisions. Some pundits are saying that the mandate for Congress is shifting from serving the nation to saving the nation. Maybe next year. And now an update on the Bali Conference. Today marks the 10th anniversary of the Kyoto Protocol, which was the largest worldwide gathering of world leaders to address the future of Earth's environmental challenges. It took 8 years to come to the final agreement, which challenged the industrialized nations to take the lead in addressing global warming and to help the industrializing nations advance in their efforts. However, the agreement had no real effect on global warming because there were no effective legal frameworks for accountability. Enter Bali, 2007, 10 years later, and with much greater evidence of a warming atmosphere. The Bali Conference, which is in its second week, had hoped to set up true mandates for reductions, hopes for binding objectives to reduce carbon emissions by between 25% and 40% by 2020, compared with 1990 levels, were removed from the draft document, however, thus drastically weakening, once again, the teeth of the treaty. This is in large part due to the lack of commitment by the world's two leading carbon emitters, which within a few months will see China move ahead of the U.S. as the world's leaders. Japan and Canada appear to be resistant to commit to mandatory constraints as well. The Bali Roadmap, as the treaty is now being referred to, is expected to be worked out by 2012 when the Kyoto Protocols are set to expire. 2 years of negotiations are expected to take place following the Bali Conference in all corners of the world to come to a final agreement. One success story is the development of an adaptation fund to help pay for improvements to poorer nations affected by global warming. The money will come from a 2% fee on all transactions carried on as part of the Clean Development Carbon Cap and Trade Mechanism, which provides carbon credits to developed nations which they can offset against their emissions targets provided they invest in clean tech projects in poorer countries. The conference continues into its second week. We will bring you a summary of the conference in next week's show. And on a final note, Indonesia announced a national effort to save the remaining orangutan population, the last of Asia's great apes, by protecting its vast tropical rainforests. With the numbers cut in half in the last 35 years to perhaps 50,000, and with an estimated 3,500 lost each year, it is only a matter of time before these amazing beings are gone from the earth. We will be following this story in the months ahead. And that's the news. So what happens when you visit one of the nation's leading universities and talk to students there about nature and the environment? That's what I did, and here's what they had to say. This is a random sampling of students who I talked with at the University of California, San Diego. I have to preface this collection by saying that students had a lot on their minds, pumped and stoked into place with endless hours of cramming. It was finals week. And a lot of students brushed me off when I asked if they'd like to talk because they were minutes away from jamming on a final exam. So I have to thank the students who you are about to hear. I invited each one to share with me what they were thinking about nature and the environment. It's a pretty interesting spectrum. So I'm talking with
Maximilian.
And Maximilian, your thoughts about nature and the environment these days, what's on your mind?
Well, I don't know, there are a lot of changes going on, I guess, but I don't know if that's even unusual. Probably changes happen all the time. And I think now that we're just becoming more aware of our actual environment and all the minor changes that can happen, we're starting to make a big deal out of stuff that I'm not even sure is that important. I mean, it could be important to us, but it's like, global warming, for instance. You know, it could just be a cyclical thing that happens, the Earth heats up and cools down. Whether or not it's man-made is probably more important, but I don't know how easy that is to find a solution to, even if we do know what is happening. But
in your cadre of friends, are people talking about these issues, getting into discussions or whatever?
Not really about the environment and stuff like that. Talk more about, like, things that aren't so heavy, you know? Just, I don't know if there's a way that my field could help out in the area. I mean, Earth is obviously important, so there'd probably be, you know, a big movement to solve these problems, if it's even possible at this point. But I think that right now we don't have it evaluated enough yet to actually know how big the problem is, if there even is a problem.
I next interrupted two male students who were apparently cramming for a test and asked if either of them had a minute to talk about nature. One student ducked back to the book, but one stood up, anxious to talk.
I'm talking to?
Gene.
What's your major here?
I'm studying management science. That's econ.
What do you think about nature, the environment?
I think it's a field that has been forgotten in modern Western civilization, where it's been taken over by materialism, about cars, about owning clothes, about owning a big house, a pool, and whatnot. We kind of forgot about the whole, you know, natural side of nature that we come from, maybe God, religion, all that. It's kind of been shoved into the corners of academics and just in general of the population concerns. It's the least of our concerns now.
So how is it that you've come to that realization?
Smoking pot.
That will definitely open up the doors of perception to
sensitive
nature.
It comes from Earth and it makes you one with Earth.
So what I'm hearing you saying is that you feel as if somehow in academia that more spiritual side, if I may use that term, seems to be not part of the messaging.
It's not only not part of it, it's also kind of hidden, you know, or just kind of shoved under the carpet for the individual to figure out on his own. You know, like, we'll teach you economy, we'll teach you politics, law, mathematics, but you have to figure out nature on your own. I think that's kind of wrong. It has underlining power, like a vast blanket, you know. I mean, oil comes from nature, oxygen comes from trees. It's a driving force that is kind of ignored in today's policies.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in L.A., but I was born in Ukraine. I grew up in L.A.
Do you consider yourself a nature person?
Yes, big time.
Big time. Talk about that.
Well, my grandma is in tune with nature. She has actually wild animals coming to her house, and she feeds like squirrels and birds, and she has cages, but the cages are always open. You know, and then that's how I was raised. I wasn't raised about owning birds. You know, I own the coolest parrot, but I was more about being kind of collaborating with nature, compromising with nature, not capturing it, but only feeding it and letting it be natural. So a lot of like my nature beliefs come from my grandma's warm heart. I mean, that's how.
So as you look out into the future here and look at the world around you, do you feel that people are missing that point?
I feel they're missing the point because we're too caught up in the frontiers of population growth and demographic changes. We're growing exponentially fast, and everybody's job is to figure out how to survive now. We're at an unnaturally large state, and like, it's not reasonable to say, oh yeah, we gotta start killing people, or, you know, stop medicine. That's kind of unethical. So we gotta cope with that. And because we have to cope with it, we focus on economic factors, political factors predominantly, not the nature factors. Because we're trying to cope with an unnatural large population.
If you could be king for a day or president, I mean, what sort of solutions would you, if you could, just make happen, if you could mandate them?
Solutions to the problem. You know, I really I'm against religion, and I think unifying as a worldwide nation instead of America, you know, Europe, it's just one nation, like a human race. I think that's the first giant leap that we have to make to understand that we're all really one. Doesn't matter how you believe in God or if you do or not. We're all one. We're all going to be born. We're all going to die. You know, we got to survive together on this instead of pointing fingers at whose fault is it that the world is unstable. We should just all together. I got to encourage more group activity. You know, we're too individualistic of a society, especially so big. It should be more group activity, like public parks, studying in public parks, picnics, like just swinging on a swing set, daydreaming in the middle of nature. That's like unheard of in a big metropolitan city. Everybody's always Starbucks, you know, going home, going this, McDonald's drive-through on the go, on the cell phone, and 350 latte. Everything is individualistic and drive-through, but it should be more communal. That way, I think we'll have more respect for nature.
How are we going to move in that direction? I mean, it's a tough. We're in a great, big, huge marketing system here that pretty much runs almost everything.
Yep.
It's just the truth, you know. Many of us aren't concerned about these kinds of things, but boy, it's a tough pitch out there because all that stuff is just so powerful.
Yeah.
Look at me. You know, I'm sitting here with my little recorder here, okay? And I got a recorder over here, and I got one over here. But however, I also realize that maybe we need to change something.
What do you think?
You asked me. Okay. We're just totally out of sync with the reality. People, generally speaking, are not aware of the limits that exist, the degree to which if we continue in this direction, we're basically going to hit a big, huge wall that isn't really being discussed. I mean, issues of even just the cost of food, for example. We're talking about water shortages. We're talking about certainly oil, you know, and resource wars and things of that nature. They're already beginning to happen. I'm not even talking about global warming.
I personally think that global warming is a natural effect to decrease population. I mean, because we're unnatural and because war is becoming unlikely because we're all being modernized and kind of smart, you know, killing a man is like, it's a waste of time. Put your mind to better thought use. I think that's just nature's way of saying, you know what, you guys are unnaturally too big for me to support you. Cut the population off.
Do you want to be a survivor?
Do I want to be a survivor? I don't think it's up for me to choose. Because I'm so young, I'm still learning, I don't believe I have the power to impact changes. But when I do establish myself in the working community, I want to go to the direction where everybody is connected to everybody through nature. Kind of like a religion based on nature, where it's kind of a synonymous belief that, if we f*** this earth, we f*** ourselves kind of thing. Now, I believe not a lot of people understand that. Have a nice day.
You bet. Thank you.
I continued my quest and was forced to empathize with university students in finals week. Is there anything more numbing to the outside world than finals? But the show must go on. I found my next study.
So I'm talking to?
Lynn.
And where are you from, Lynn?
I'm from Oceanside, California.
Just up the road here.
Yes.
Yeah. And what's your major here?
Human biology.
That's a terrific subject to be talking about, the nature and the environment, in its many aspects. For you, when you think about these issues, what is it that you think about, or your concerns or your passions?
I kind of feel that a lot of people are just ignoring the environment and plowing their way on through and just living their own life without really being mindful of what's happening to the earth. But I think that we're really connected to the earth, so what we do really has an impact on it. So that's why I think if people become more aware of conserving, then the earth will be saved and we won't have to worry so much of mass extinction. But I decided to study human biology because I feel that human is also important, not in the sense that we are dominating and we're on top of the world, but we have to take care of ourselves, and once we take care of ourselves, then we can take care of the earth as well, and that's how I feel about it.
Do some of the issues that are facing us these days concern you in that regard?
Yes. Well, since we live in the desert, I'm just appalled at how a lot of people just waste water, so I try to turn off the shower and sink when I'm doing things instead of letting it go to waste, because water is really important and it's just depleted nowadays. The world's getting bigger and there's just not enough room, but I think it's possible. I'm trying to be optimistic, so... Yeah.
I'm doing this because I'm optimistic that we as humans have the intelligence and we have the technologies now to share information and try to make a difference and communicate with each other, and hopefully we can change some of the destructive tendencies that we have. And there's all sorts of extraordinary technologies that people are dreaming about, making billions and billions of dollars. And I think that's great. The more we can make money off of doing great stuff, the world will become a better place.
Yeah.
So that's always what I'm trying to promote, is this concept of making a better world through our wisdom. Just on a personal level, when you think about nature, what is something that really
attracts you or that you're attracted to?
It's very refreshing. I just had a final and I felt so depleted of energy, and just sitting out here, it's really nice to get the refreshing oxygen.
It was refreshing to find such passion and awareness in the new tribe. And then sometimes...
Hi, I'm talking with...
Caleb.
You know, what are you thinking about the Earth these days? I'm just curious what you're thinking about these things.
You know, I like to think that there's room for all of God's creatures right next to the mashed potatoes, you know. I like the Earth. I like vegetables, fruits, grains, beef. Beef's my favorite animal. You know, I love the Earth. It's, you know, provides so much for us. You know, air, oxygen, carbon dioxide, poison oak, just, you know, all that fun stuff. Deer, cows, venison. Have you ever had venison stew? Wonderful.
I actually prefer elk.
I've had elk spaghetti. I have a relative who's, for health reasons, he only eats meat that he hunts because it's healthier. And so when I went to his house, we had elk spaghetti. It's really good.
If you think about what's happening to some of the creatures around the world, some of the habitats that are being taken down, for example, does that concern you at all? I mean, in other words, if you care about, even from the perspective of just eating deer, if there are forests that are being destroyed or whatever else, does that concern you at all?
Well, I figure, you know, natural selection, you know, for the animals, but, you know, trees, I think they're kind of selfish. I mean, they just stand there all day, and so some trees I think deserve to be cut down because they're just ugly.
Now, where'd you grow up?
Chula Vista.
Have you had a chance to travel much around the states? Or?
I've been in most of the states, most of the southern states. I'm from the south, my family. So, you know, Georgia, Alabama, been to Europe, Norway, Mexico. I know quite a few places.
When you go to those places, what do you notice about there?
You know, Norway is a beautiful country. The fjords, you know, they have waterfalls, they have these beautiful canyons, they, you know, these mile-long tunnels. I felt the Netherlands, when I went to the Netherlands, they were kind of dirty. Everything just had like a layer of grime on it. And Ireland was beautiful. You know, they had the greenish trees you'd ever see in Ireland.
So do you think it's important that we keep that beauty in the environment?
Yes. I like, you know, hunting. We're cutting down big forests and stuff like that. But, you know, we do have, you know, places like Yosemite, which are preserved, which I also have done rock climbing in. You know, places like Yosemite might not be the way they are and available for people to go out and climb and enjoy if we didn't preserve them, the habitats also.
Now, there's lots of talk about global warming. Just what are your thoughts on that?
I'm still out on the global warming. I mean, there's a lot of evidence for it, but I've also heard other explanations that seem just as plausible. And, yeah. Yeah.
Not exactly a setback, but at least a sidestep. And then...
Hi, I'm talking to...
Catherine.
And what's your major?
My major is biology.
I have to assume you do think about nature and the environment at least a little bit.
Yes.
What is it that you spend your time thinking about?
In terms of the environment, I'm really thinking about, like, conservation. Like, what are we doing to expand our national park system and maintain the parks we have, and, like, wildlife areas, conservation of species, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Do you have thoughts about how that might take place, what some of the priorities may be?
I think there aren't very high priorities for expanding the national parks and for expanding wildlife areas, which I think is really unfortunate because, like, it really shows in the extinction rates and preserving biodiversity in America and across the world. I think expanding forest areas and wildlife preserves should be a priority.
That's a very significant topic, and I'm glad you can talk about that. Why is that important?
Well, it's just really important because the Earth works in such a complex way, and we need these systems that have been in place in the world for so long. They keep the water clean naturally. Like, we just need all the trees and plants that do their natural job to keep doing it so that we don't throw the Earth so off balance that it may become unlivable.
Are you at all concerned that we may be reaching a tipping point of some sort?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a concern. Eventually, you know, we're going to run out, and yeah.
As you know, once a form of collapse takes place in a natural system, since everything is interconnected and much interdependent, things can really start to go down. As you look into the future, there's a lot of talk about mass extinction and things of that nature. What are your thoughts personally in terms of the future and how this may turn out?
Well, actually, right now we're in a mass extinction. So, I mean, if we're not going to change and start trying to preserve more species, like, it's just going to keep getting worse. We're going to keep losing more and more species. So we have to do something. I mean, there's nothing telling us we shouldn't do something.
That's good. I've talked with a number of people here, and I must say there's quite a diversity of perspectives and awareness. These are difficult choices that we have to make in these regards. What are some thoughts that you may have that you think could make a difference?
Government plays a big part in what happens, like in policy, globally and locally. So people have to do their research, and if it's something, if they'd like to see a change in how people care for the environment, then they need to find someone that will help them do that. So.
Now, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in the Bay Area, near San Francisco.
Within your peer group, your friends and things like that, what do you think is the level of concern?
Well, my friends, I'm not sure if they're necessarily thinking about these topics as often, but I mean, when people hear about global warming, I mean, I think our generation does think about it a little bit more because it's something that we've kind of grown up with. Like hearing, you know, the planet's getting hotter. It didn't used to be this hot, so I think it's something that we're kind of programmed to think about a little bit more.
Do you get involved in politics at all?
Yeah, I do. But, yeah,
Any thoughts about who you seem to think may have a good idea, maybe on track, may have share some of your concerns?
Not really. I'm kind of discouraged by the presidential debates so far. I mean, I haven't really seen a candidate that stands out to me too much, so for any party. So I think our political system needs to be more straightforward. People need to be more straightforward with their opinions and their beliefs, not just pushing a party. So
the whole world is developing now. China, for example, is coming online big time. Are you concerned about that?
I think that will have an effect on our economy because we're oil dependent and they're becoming oil dependent. There will be kind of a squeeze for resources. So if there are companies that are doing research to find alternatives, but I mean, I think we kind of have to speed it up a little bit and be ahead of the curve so that we don't, I mean, because China is expanding very rapidly, and I think we're not anticipating the effect that it's going to have so soon. So,
in terms of clean tech energy sources, are there some that appeal to you more than others?
Not really. I mean, I think they're all kind of in a starting phase. They all need some work. So we'll see what researchers come up with. That's not really my field, so.
This actually represents an honest sampling, albeit quite small, of the GW generation. No, not George W., although that too has a unique significance, but rather Global One. Are they concerned?
I'm talking to
Eric Musgrave.
Hi, Eric. What are you thinking about these days when it relates to nature of the environment?
Mostly what we can do to help keep the environment in its current situation and possibly reverse the effects of global warming as they've happened. And even now, I understand that we don't fully know the extent of what has happened global warming-wise, but anything we can do to prevent and or push that back is good.
Mm-hmm. What are some of your thoughts about how that might happen, how you might participate?
Well, hydrogen cars are a big deal, especially in America, because we have more cars than any other nation. So the more we can move towards alternative fuels and less emissions in that sort of arena will be better for the environment. And pushing for power sources for just general power that are not based off of burning fossil fuels and whatnot that spew that type of waste into the environment.
Now, are there some of the clean tech technologies, are some of those your favorites that you prefer to think about?
Well, one of my professors here is doing a lot of research on cold fusion, which, if they get it figured out, provides a ton of energy just from water molecules. So if that's figured out, basically all those emissions for power usage across the country drop to zero.
And if they don't, then what's the fallback?
Well, they're close. It's simply a matter at this point of being able to get that process that they have figured out into a quickly repeatable and easily reproducible cycle to be used for mainstream production of electricity.
Are you involved in any way in this arena in your studies here?
I want to be, and I've been meaning to go to his office hours, so actually sometime this week I'll be going in to talk to him and see if I can get on that project.
Uh-huh. What's your major?
Bioengineering.
Well, you're in the right place for that.
Definitely so.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you very much.
So my analysis of the new intelligentsia. Actually, it seemed quite familiar, as I once had been a student at a large university during a time of environmental activism with war raging off in a foreign land. I remember thinking then that the things happening were, to a large extent, beyond my control. It was that old guard that was running things and had all the power. And I recall a moment when I realized, aha, I will be part of that old guard someday, and when that happens, we'll change the world. Well, here we are, old guardians and new guardians. And as the Bali Conference indicates, we are making a difference, which makes me wonder once again about the leadership here. What are they waiting for? Perhaps retaking our power back may be an important first step to changing the world. I know I'm ready. Wishing you all protection from the storm, this is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Tuesday or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.